This is the Personal Injury Update COE for January 2023. Every month I compile the personal injury summaries that have been posted on the New York Appellate Digest website into monthly reversal reports. It is the reversal report, the personal injury reversal report for January 2023, which functions as the written materials for the CLE course. All the page references are to that January 2023 personal injury reversal report, and there's a link to that report on the CLE podcast page. First case is Galloway, pages 6 and 7. A prison inmate sued the state alleging correction officers assaulted him. The issue is respondeat superior. Is the state, as the employer of the correction officers, liable for the assault by its employees? To recover against the state, the inmate had to prove two elements. One, the assault was within the scope of the correction officer's employment, and two, the assault was foreseeable from the employer's, that's the state's, perspective. The Court of Claims held that the assault was outside the scope of the officer's employment and therefore the state was not liable. The Third Department reversed, finding that under the facts, which were fully developed because there was a trial in the Court of Claims, under the facts, the assault was within the scope of the officer's employment and the assault was foreseeable by the state. The case was sent back for a determination of damages. Again, because there was a trial, the facts were fully developed, and the reversal by the Third Department was on the facts as well as the law. The court wrote, "While it is our view that the correction officer's use of force was excessive, the ensuing investigations of the incident effectively condoned the conduct of the correction officers and tacitly found them to be engaged in actions that were within the scope of employment. This evidence reflects that prison officials determined that the conduct of the correction officers was appropriate under the circumstances and fell within the scope of employment. In light of claimant's report accusing one of the corrections officers of inappropriate contact with the claimant, which preceded this incident, it was clearly foreseeable that a tense encounter could result in the context of normal employment-related activities in the prison." So the most important issues for the court here were whether the state, as the officer's employer, condoned the officer's violent conduct, and whether the state, as the officer's employer, knew there was tension between the officers and the inmate who was assaulted. So the unique facts of this case determined the outcome. Next is Muchnick on page 7. This case presents a discovery issue. There was a dispute between the parties, and the plaintiff's attorney brought a motion to compel the defendant to appear at a deposition under threat of precluding the evidence. Supreme Court granted the motion. The Second Department reversed because plaintiff's attorney's good faith affirmation was not sufficient. Here's how the court explained what should be in a good faith affirmation. Pursuant to 22 NYCRR section 202.7 subdivisions A and C, a motion relating to disclosure must be accompanied by an affirmation from moving counsel attesting to a good faith effort to resolve the issues raised in the motion, including the time, place, and nature of the consultation, as well as the issues discussed. So when there is a discovery dispute and a party makes a motion to get the court involved, the motion must be accompanied by a sufficient good faith affidavit, which details the attempts to resolve the dispute. Next is MS versus Rhinek Union Free School District. It's on page 8. Here, a student, an infant, sued the school district. The General Municipal Law Section 50-I, Subdivision 1C, requires that a suit against the school district be commenced within 1 year and 90 days of the incident. The question was whether the infancy toll of a statute of limitations in CPLR 208 applies to that general municipal law limitation period, 1 year and 90 days. Supreme Court said no. Second Department reversed and said yes, the infancy toll in CPLR 208 does apply to the 1 year 90-day time limit for a lawsuit against a school district in the general municipal law. As the court explained it, Supreme Court erred in concluding that any claim by the infant plaintiff based upon incidents that occurred prior to May 31, 2017 would be time barred. CPLR 208 tolls a statute of limitations for the period of infancy, including the limitations set forth in General Municipal Law, Section 50-I, Subdivision 1. It is undisputed that the infant plaintiff was an infant at the time of the events underlying this action and at the time the action was commenced. Next is Matter of R.M. versus Board of Education, pages 9 and 10. This is another lawsuit against the school district on behalf of a student. The student was seeking leave to file a late notice of claim in an action that alleged negligent supervision on the playground. The plaintiff apparently ran into a piece of playground equipment when he was being chased by classmates. Whenever a petitioner seeks permission from the court to file a late notice of claim, the most important question is whether the party being sued, here the Board of Education, had notice of the facts of the incident within 90 days. In other words, was the Board of Education made aware of this potential lawsuit within 90 days of the injury? Sometimes the existence of an accident report is enough to alert the party being sued to a potential lawsuit. There was an accident report here, and Supreme Court granted the petition for leave to file a late notice. But the Second Department reversed, in part because the content of the accident report was not sufficient to alert school officials to a potential lawsuit. The school employees supervising recess didn't see the incident, and the accident report did not make it clear how the student was injured. Also, the petitioners didn't offer a reasonable excuse for failing to file the notice of claim within 90 days. But I think the important takeaway from this case is that the mere existence of a contemporary accident report does not guarantee a court will find the party being sued had actual knowledge of a potential lawsuit within the 90 days. The court wrote, "The accident claim form states that three school employees were supervising recess but did not see the infant petitioner become injured. This, standing alone, is insufficient to establish actual knowledge of a potential negligent supervision claim because it's well established that schools cannot reasonably be expected to continuously supervise and control all movements and activities of students. The petitioners also failed to establish that the school board had actual knowledge of the facts constituting their other two claims. The petitioners identify no factual connection between the recess supervisors not seeing the infant petitioner's injury and either the allegedly defective nature of the playground equipment or the instruction given or not given to students at recess. It's not even clear from the description of the incident on the accident claim form whether the school was aware that the infant petitioner injured himself on a metal joint, as alleged in the petition and the notice of claim. Thus, the petitioners failed to establish that the school board had actual knowledge of the facts constituting their claims within the required 90-day period after the incident." So again, just because an accident report was made at the time of an incident doesn't mean that a court will find that the defendant had timely knowledge of a potential lawsuit. If the accident report is not clear, about the facts, then the notice is insufficient. Next is the Taopanta, that's Taopanta, case on pages 10 and 11. This is a Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 action. The plaintiff and a co-worker were attempting to lift a heavy door onto a truck. The door was too heavy for them to hold up. The door fell and injured plaintiff's hand. The plaintiff presented evidence that no hoists, forklifts, or other lifting devices were available. Supreme Court denied plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. The First Department reversed and granted plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. Labor Law Section 240 Subdivision 1 is a plaintiff-friendly statute. If an object that must be lifted is heavy and there are no lifting devices available, that constitutes a failure to provide a worker with adequate safety equipment, which warrants summary judgment under the statute. As the court explained it, the affidavit of his employer's foreman, who admittedly did not witness the accident, did not dispute most of the facts relevant to plaintiff's claim. The foreman's affidavit failed to raise a question of fact about the door's weight, since he didn't provide any basis for his bare claim that the door weighed about 100 to 120 pounds and could easily be lifted by two workers without the use of a hoist or forklift. Also, the precise weight of the door, whether it fell from a height of 7 feet or 3.5 feet, or whether a dolly was being used when it fell, are not material. It's undisputed that no lifting devices contemplated by Labor Law Section 240 Subdivision 1 were available at the job site, and the plaintiff's injuries flow directly from the application of force of the force of gravity to the object. And here the plaintiff submitted evidence that the door weighed about 300 pounds and it was too much for him and his co-worker to lift. So the main reason summary judgment was appropriate here is that the employer was not able to dispute plaintiff's allegations about the weight of the door and the absence of lifting devices. Next is the Sotelo case, S-O-T-E-L-O, pages 11 and 12. This is another example of how plaintiff-friendly Labor Law Section 240 Subdivision 1 is. Plaintiff fell into a hole or a ditch covered by a tarp on his way to a bathroom at the work site. Apparently there had been a plank across the ditch, which was replaced with the tarp. The facts that there was a closer bathroom and that no one witnessed plaintiff's fall did not preclude summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff. The important fact was the absence of a safety device, that being the plank over the ditch. Supreme Court denied summary judgment, and the First Department reversed, granting plaintiff's motion. The court explained, defendants failed to raise an issue of fact as to whether plaintiff was the sole proximate cause of his accident. Defendants contend that plaintiff chose to use a bathroom further away from his workstation and attempted to cross over the ditch without first inspecting the covering that had replaced the plank before stepping on it. However, these circumstances still demonstrate that plaintiff's accident was the result of the absence of a safety device and raise only an issue as to plaintiff's comparative negligence, which is not a defense to a Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 claim. The fact that plaintiff was the only witness to his accident doesn't preclude summary judgment in his favor, because there's nothing in the record that controverted his account of the accident or called into question his credibility. So one of the takeaways here is that a plaintiff's comparative negligence is not a defense to a Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 cause of action and will not preclude summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff. Next is Arias on page 12. This is another Labor Law Section 240 Subdivision 1 case. Here the plaintiff was provided with safety equipment. but the court found that the equipment wasn't sufficient to protect him. The plaintiff was wearing a safety harness and a retractable lanyard when he fell, and as he fell, he struck his head. Although the lanyard prevented him from hitting the floor, the abrupt stop of the fall by the lanyard injured his shoulder. Supreme Court denied plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, but the First Department reversed and granted the motion. Plaintiff's injuries demonstrated that the harness and the lanyard did not provide adequate protection. As the court explained it, the record establishes that the safety devices proved inadequate to shield the injured worker from harm directly flowing from the application of the force of gravity. The fact that the plaintiff sustained injuries to his right shoulder and back when his body was caused to be pulled back up abruptly by his safety harness and lanyard demonstrates a lack of adequate protection. Next is Calle, C-A-L-L-E, on page 13. This case is a rare example of a labor law section 240 subdivision 1 action which was dismissed because the plaintiff was deemed to be the sole proximate cause of his injury. The general rule is that a plaintiff's comparative negligence is not a bar to summary judgment in plaintiff's favor on a labor law section 240 subdivision 1 cause of action. But when a plaintiff's actions are the only cause of the accident, plaintiff doesn't have a cause of action under that statute. Here, plaintiff was working in an excavated area. Ladders were available for him to climb out of the excavated area, and he had been instructed to use the ladders to climb out. Instead of using the ladders, plaintiff stepped on a wooden brace and fell. Supreme Court had denied the defendant's motion for summary judgment, but the Second Department granted the motion. The crucial facts here were 1, adequate safety devices had been provided, and 2, plaintiff had been instructed to use them. Because plaintiff failed to use the ladders, his actions constituted the sole proximate cause of his fall, and he did not have a viable cause of action under labor law 240 subdivision 1. Next is Nooney on page 13. It's another labor law case. Here the issue was whether the work plaintiff was doing was routine maintenance, which is not covered under the labor law, or repair, which is covered. Injury doing routine maintenance, again, is not covered by either labor law section 240 subdivision 1 or section 241 subdivision 6. Plaintiff fell while replacing ceiling tiles in a facility which was not being renovated or constructed. Supreme Court had granted defendant's motion for summary judgment. The Second Department reversed, finding there was a question of fact whether plaintiff was repairing the premises, which is covered by the labor law. The court explained it like this. In determining whether a particular activity constitutes repairing, courts are careful to distinguish between repairs and routine maintenance, since routine maintenance work performed in a non-construction, non-renovation context is not a covered activity. Here, the city failed to establish that the tasks plaintiff was performing at the time of the accident were associated with routine maintenance, which is not a covered activity under the labor law, rather than repair work, which may be covered, even if it is not part of a larger renovation project. So the reason defendant's motion for summary judgment was denied here is that the defendants did not eliminate questions of fact about the nature of plaintiff's work. In other words, the defendant offered insufficient proof that plaintiff's work was routine maintenance. Next is Guinn, G-U-I-N-N, on page 15. This is a medical malpractice case. The issue is whether plaintiff signing a consent form precluded a cause of action for lack of informed consent. Supreme Court had granted defendant's motion for summary judgment, and the Second Department reversed. The court explained the proof requirements for a lack of informed consent cause of action as follows. To establish a cause of action to recover damages for malpractice based on lack of informed consent, a plaintiff must prove, one, that the person providing the professional treatment failed to disclose alternatives thereto and failed to inform the patient of reasonably foreseeable risks associated with the treatment and the alternatives that a reasonable medical practitioner would have disclosed in the same circumstances. Two, these are the proof requirements, that a reasonably prudent patient in the same position would not have undergone the treatment if he or she had been fully informed. And three, that the lack of informed consent is a proximate cause of the injury. The fact that a plaintiff signed a consent form standing alone does not establish a defendant's prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law. Here, the defendant's submissions failed to establish that the plaintiff was informed about the risks and benefits of inducing labor immediately and the available alternatives. Thus, the defendants failed to establish the absence of triable issues of fact with respect to the cause of action alleging lack of informed consent. So the takeaway here, the elements of a lack of informed consent cause of action are complex and precise. And if the defendant, in making a motion to dismiss based on a signed consent form, doesn't address each of those elements in their motion papers, the motion for summary judgment will be denied, despite the presence of a signed consent form. At this point, I'm going to insert a verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation. A verification code for this 2023 Personal Injury Update CLE, January 2023, is consent. Again, a verification code for this January 2023 Personal Injury Update CLE is consent. The next case is Economy Premier Assurance Company on page 17. This is a products liability case, and the issue was whether New York could exercise long-arm jurisdiction over an Italian company which made a component, it was a supply line hose, in a dishwasher manufactured and sold by a non-party. The underlying action was a property damage insurance claim, presumably resulting from the failure of the hose. Supreme Court held that New York had long-arm jurisdiction, but the Second Department reversed, finding there was no evidence the Italian company purposefully conducted business in New York. The court wrote, "The defendant was an Italian corporation with its business located in that country. It manufactured, sold, and distributed its goods in Italy, and had no office or agent in New York. The plaintiff failed to show that the defendant purposefully availed itself of the privilege of conducting activities in New York so as to subject it to long-arm jurisdiction pursuant to CPLR Section 302, Subdivision A1. The plaintiff also failed to make a showing that personal jurisdiction exists under CPLR Section 302, Subdivision A3. Since the defendant was not subject to the jurisdiction of New York, the plaintiff's service of process upon it was not valid, and it cites CPLR Section 313. So the key reason that the Second Department felt that long-arm jurisdiction was not appropriate here is because there was no evidence that the Italian company purposefully sought to do business in New York. That was the operative word that the case turned on. The defendant did not purposefully seek to do business in New York and therefore was not subject to long-arm jurisdiction. Next is Fiuzzi, F-I-U-Z-Z-I, on page 18. This is another products liability case. Apparently, the plaintiff tried out an exercise band which was on display in a store. He held down one end of the band with his foot, but it slipped out and hit him in the eye. The breach of an implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose and the breach of an implied warranty of merchantability causes of action survived a motion to dismiss in Supreme Court, but the First Department dismissed the complaint for failure to state a cause of action. The court wrote, a breach of implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, that's UCC section 2-315, requires allegations that defendants had reason to know any particular purpose for which the goods are used, and that plaintiff relied on defendant's skill or judgment to select or furnish those suitable goods. The complaint did not allege any particular purpose of the exercise band other than its ordinary purpose for exercise, and there were no allegations that defendants knew or should have known about any particular purpose for which the goods were purchased, nor were there any allegations that plaintiff relied upon defendant's skill or judgment in selecting the goods. Plaintiff also failed to state a cause of action for breach of the implied warranty of merchantability, which provides that goods are fit for the ordinary purposes for which such goods are used, that's UCC section 2-314, to plead a breach of the implied warranty of merchantability, a plaintiff must allege that goods are defective such that they were not reasonably fit for the ordinary purpose for which they were used, that the defect in the goods was a substantial factor in causing the injury, and that the alleged defect existed at the time the goods left the manufacturer or entity in the line of distribution. So I guess the takeaway here is that the UCC defines in detail the warranties of fitness for a particular purpose and merchantability. And to survive a motion to dismiss, the complaint must allege facts which support all those complex elements of those rather opaque definitions. And the failure to do so here warranted dismissal of the complaint. Next is Matter of Compagnone, C-O-M-P-A-G-N-O-N-E, pages 19 and 20. This is an action by a police officer for accidental disability retirement benefits under the Retirement and Social Security Law. The issue in these accidental disability cases is whether the injury was caused by an accident as opposed to the usual hazards associated with police work or the work of a fireman. The officer described two falls. In one instance, the officer, at night, noticed a light on in a house which was under construction. In walking around the house, he fell into a 3-foot-deep hole. In the other instance, the officer, at night, slipped and fell on a slippery outside wooden stairway as he was investigating a suspicious party in a parking lot. In a full-fledged opinion by Justice Gary, the Third Department held neither fall was an unexpected event. Therefore, neither fall was an accident within the meaning of the Retirement and Social Security Law. Therefore, the officer did not qualify for accidental disability retirement benefits. The court wrote, when carrying out some police duties, an officer on foot may encounter, as part of the work being performed, a vast array of conditions, many of which are not easily traversed and can cause a fall. Encountering such conditions while actively engaged in police duties often is not an unexpected event. And the comptroller was the initial level which denied the benefits, may find a fall to be an inherent risk of the job. Now, this is a comprehensive opinion. It's a full-fledged opinion signed by Judge Gary. And it should be consulted on the issue of what constitutes a compensable accident under the retirement and Social Security law. It's a unique definition of the word accident. Next is Lall, N-A-L-L, on page 22. Here the plaintiff was a housekeeper injured when she fell on the job. She sued the homeowner in Supreme Court, but there was a question whether, because she was on the job, workers' compensation was her only remedy against her employer. In this situation, Supreme Court should grant a defendant's motion for summary judgment in Supreme Court and refer the case to the Workers' Compensation Board because the disposition of the board is a prerequisite to a civil suit in Supreme Court. The court wrote, primary jurisdiction with respect to determinations as to the applicability of the workers' compensation law has been vested in the Workers' Compensation Board, and it's therefore inappropriate for the courts to express views with respect thereto pending determination by the board. Where the issue of the applicability of the workers' compensation law is in dispute, and where a plaintiff fails to litigate that issue before the board, a court should not express an opinion as to the availability of compensation, but should refer the matter to the board because the board's disposition of the plaintiff's compensation claim is a jurisdictional predicate to the civil action. Here, Supreme Court should have referred the matter to the board for a hearing and determination as to whether the plaintiff is relegated to benefits under the workers' compensation law. So the takeaway, if the facts are such that a plaintiff who has brought suit in Supreme Court may be covered by the workers' compensation law for the same incident, Supreme Court should transfer the matter to Workers' Compensation Board. A ruling by the board is a jurisdictional predicate to any civil action. Next is Polanco, pages 22 and 23. The issue in this slip and fall case is whether the defendant's supermarket demonstrated a lack of constructive notice of the grapes on the floor where the plaintiff slipped and fell. A lack of constructive notice is demonstrated by proof the area was inspected or cleaned close in time to the slip and fall. Supreme Court found that the proof was sufficient and granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment, but the First Department found that the proof was insufficient and reversed. The court wrote, while defendant showed that it did not create or have actual notice of loose grapes in the produce aisle at the time of plaintiff's accident, defendant failed to submit sufficient evidence to show as a matter of law that it lacked constructive notice of the condition. Specifically, defendant failed to show that its cleaning routine was followed on the day of the accident. Its store manager testified generally that an employee was assigned to inspect and clean the produce aisle throughout the day, and that he personally walked the aisles during the day, but he did not testify regarding any specific cleaning or inspection of the area in question on the day of plaintiff's fall. A vice president testified that the cleaning protocols were verbal and were based on common sense, but did not offer any information as to what steps were taken during the last cleaning cycle prior to plaintiff's accident, which also was not sufficient to establish lack of constructive notice. So the takeaway here, the only way to prove a lack of constructive notice is to prove the area of the slip and fall was in fact cleaned or inspected shortly before the fall. Proof of general cleaning or inspection routines is not enough. Unless that proof is there, the defendant's motion for summary judgment will be denied. Next is Forbes on pages 23 and 24. In this slip and fall case, the defendant was the property owner's snow removal contractor. The narrow question here was whether the contractor was entitled to summary judgment in this action brought by a plaintiff who fell on the property. The usual rule is that the plaintiff in an ice and snow slip and fall case who is not a party to the snow removal contract cannot sue the contractor. One exception to that rule is when the contractor launches an instrument of harm which caused the fall. This is called an Espinal, E-S-P-I-N-A-L exception, which is the name of the seminal case, the Espinal case. If the plaintiff alleges the snow removal contractor created the dangerous condition which caused the fall, another way to put that, if the plaintiff can show that the contractor launched an instrument of harm, the Espinal exception, then the complaint states a cause of action against the contractor. This case deals with what happens when the plaintiff sues the snow removal contractor but does not allege that the Espinal does not allege the Espinal exception, that being that the contractor launched an instrument of harm which caused the slip and fall. The answer to that question is the contractor need only demonstrate the plaintiff was not a party to the snow removal contract to be entitled to summary judgment dismissing the complaint. And that's what the Second Department held, dismissing the action against the snow removal contractor. So the general rule is only a party to the contract can sue based on the existence of the contract. There's an exception to that rule. If the contractor created so-called launched an instrument of harm, which harmed someone who was not a party to the contract, that third party can sue based on the creation of that dangerous condition. And in a case like this against the snow removal contractor, if the plaintiff doesn't plead the existence of this Espinal exception in the complaint, the contractor, as the defendant, doesn't have to raise that issue. The contractor, in that case, only needs to state in the answer that the plaintiff was not a party to the snow removal contract. That's enough to warrant summary judgment in favor of the contractor when no Espinal exception was alleged by the plaintiff. Next is the Pettinato, P-E-T-T-I-N-A-T-O case, pages 24 and 25. This case concerns a defendant's right to an independent medical exam, called an IME. Here, the plaintiff fell in a shower and was injured in her pelvic area. She underwent a comprehensive gynecological exam, which included a pelvic exam by her treating physician. The defendant sought an independent medical examination, which was just as extensive as the treating physician's exam. Supreme Court limited the defendant's exam by excluding the pelvic exam. The First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Renwick over a dissenting opinion, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant was entitled to the same full exam that plaintiff's treating physician conducted, including the pelvic exam. The court wrote, "Applying basic principles of CPLR discovery to require a plaintiff who puts her gynecological condition at issue to submit to an IME in the form of a gynecological examination that includes a routine pelvic examination is consistent with our role as judges to be fair and balanced even in the most difficult cases. A plaintiff who has voluntarily submitted to a routine pelvic examination by her own treating physician without adverse effects should be required to undergo a similar examination that is material and necessary to defend against her claims that she sustained serious gynecological injuries." So the takeaway here, if the plaintiff is relying on a comprehensive physical exam by plaintiff's treating physician to prove the injuries, A defendant is entitled to conduct an independent medical examination, which is equally comprehensive. Next is Kitziger, pages 26 and 27. This case raises two issues: the foreseeability of the accident and the liability of an out-of-possession landlord. Plaintiff was standing on a couch in the defendant tenant's karaoke bar called Planet Rose when she fell backwards through a glass storefront window. The question was whether the tenant, the owner of Planet Rose, was negligent in not installing tempered glass. The first department found there was a question of fact on the issue because patrons routinely stood on the couch and defendant was aware that tempered glass was the best option for a storefront. She was told that when one of the storefront windows, which had broken, was replaced. The court wrote, "The owner of Planet Rose acknowledged that when vandals smashed another window in the storefront years earlier, the glazier recommended tempered glass as the best option for a storefront, and she accepted that recommendation. She also testified that there were many times over the years that patrons stood on the couch, as shown in photographs posted on Planet Rose's social media. So the record presents issues of fact as to whether defendants were negligent in failing to use tempered glass in the window to prevent a foreseeable injury." The other issue decided in this case was that the out-of-possession landlord was not obligated by contract to make repairs or maintain the premises and therefore was not liable for plaintiff's injuries. The court wrote, "The landlord demonstrated it had relinquished sufficient control of the premises to be deemed an out-of-possession landlord, and as such was not contractually obligated to make repairs or maintain the premises. Accordingly, its liability is limited to claims based on a significant structural or design defect that is contrary to a specific statutory safety provision, which is not an issue here." So generally, if the lease makes it clear that the landlord, the out-of-possession landlord, is not responsible for repairs and maintenance, the only time the out-of-possession landlord can be held liable is if the injury was caused by a significant structural or design defect that was contrary to a statutory safety provision. Next is Matter of Salaza, S-A-L-A-Z-A, pages 27 and 28. This is another late notice of claim case in an action against the municipality to preserve the potential lawsuit. The potential plaintiff is required to file a notice of the claim with the municipality within 90 days of the injury. Here the plaintiff slipped and fell because of a defect in the road. She sued the City of New York. Supreme Court granted leave to file a late notice, but the Second Department reversed. In addition to the police accident report, there were relevant documents from a police investigation and from the Department of Transportation. But the Second Department found the documents didn't include enough facts to alert the city to a potential lawsuit stemming from the fall. So the city did not have actual notice of the essential facts within 90 days. In addition, the Second Department found that the petitioner did not have a reasonable excuse for the delay in seeking leave to file a late notice and didn't demonstrate the city would not be prejudiced by the delay. To sum up how the Second Department analyzed this request to file a late notice, the court asked three questions. First, did the municipality have timely notice that the incident was a potential lawsuit? The court answered no, despite the contemporary police accident report and other investigative documents. Second question the court asked, was the excuse for the delay reasonable? And the court answered no and noted that there was an unexplained 9-month delay. Third question, did the petitioner demonstrate the municipality would not be prejudiced by the delay? Apparently, the petitioner didn't address this element. This element is part of the petitioner's burden in requesting permission to file a late notice. Next is Widener on pages 28 and 29. This case again raises the issue of an out-of-possession landlord's liability for an injury on the landlord's property. Plaintiff slipped and fell because of a defect in the floor in the tenant's premises. Supreme Court granted the landlord's motion for summary judgment, but the second department reversed. The lease did not demonstrate the landlord did not have a duty to make non-structural repairs to the floor, so there was a question of fact about the landlord's liability. The lesson here is, if the lease is unclear about what the out-of-possession landlord's repair duties are, that could preclude summary judgment on the out-of-possession landlord's behalf. The court wrote, an out-of-possession landlord is not liable for injuries that occur on its premises unless the landlord has retained control over the premises and has a duty imposed by statute or assumed by contract or a course of conduct. Where the terms of an agreement are unambiguous, interpretation is a question of law for the court. Here, according to the lease, the landlord was required to, quote, make all structural, exterior walls, floor, and roof repairs and replacements to tenant's building. Now, there's a comma after structural. So again, the quote is, make all structural, comma, exterior walls, comma, floor and roof repairs and replacements to tenant's building. Contrary to the defendant's contention, pursuant to the lease agreement, its duty to repair the floor was not limited to floor conditions which were structural in nature, and it failed to establish that it had no duty to repair the alleged structural condition, non-structural condition at issue. So the takeaway here is an out-of-possession landlord's repair duties can be controlled by the terms of the lease. And here it wasn't clear that the landlord's duty was to repair only structural damage. Next is the Reyes case, R-E-Y-E-S, pages 29 and 30. This slip and fall case illustrates what can happen if there are two proximate causes for the fall, one being plaintiff's own action. The plaintiff tripped over a hose he had placed on a step, but the plaintiff alleged he didn't see the hose because of inadequate lighting. So there were two proximate causes, one ascribed to the plaintiff and the other to the defendant. Supreme Court granted defendant summary judgment motion, but the second department reversed. At this point, I'm going to insert a verification code. A verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this January 2023 personal injury update CLE is proximate. Again, a verification code for this January 2023 personal injury update CLE to be placed on your attorney affirmation is proximate. Okay, returning to this Reyes case where there were two proximate causes for the slip and fall. One was plaintiff's fault, and the other was allegedly the defendant's fault. The court wrote, there can be more than one proximate cause of an accident, and generally, it is for the trier of fact to determine the issue of proximate cause. Here, defendant failed to eliminate triable issues of fact as to whether inadequate lighting in the area of the subject steps contributed to the plaintiff's accident. So the takeaway here, even if the plaintiff's own action was a proximate cause of the accident, if it's alleged that the defendant's act or omission was also a proximate cause, defendant will not be entitled to summary judgment. Next is Howard on pages 30 and 31. This is a toxic tort asbestos case, and it raises a summary judgment stage evidentiary issue. The plaintiff alleged he had been exposed to asbestos when repairing pumps manufactured by the defendant. The defendant moved for summary judgment on the ground that the plaintiff could not prove causation. But the Third Department explained that a defendant bringing a summary judgment motion has the burden of proof. Any weakness in the plaintiff's proof is not relevant to the defendant's initial burden on the motion. Here, the defendant failed to affirmatively demonstrate the asbestos in its pumps did not cause plaintiff's injury, so the motion should have been denied without considering what plaintiff's proof might have been. As the court explained, in order to establish entitlement to judgment as a matter of law, defendant bore the initial burden, that's the initial burden bringing the motion, of demonstrating that its respective product could not have contributed to the causation of Howard's asbestos-related injuries. Defendant could not prevail on its motion for summary judgment by merely pointing to gaps in the plaintiff's proof. In other words, defendant could not simply argue that plaintiffs could not affirmatively prove causation, but rather it had to affirmatively prove as a matter of law that there was no causation. Next is another asbestos case, Matter of New York Asbestos Litigation, pages 31 and 32. The issue here was whether New York had jurisdiction over the case. The defendant manufactured valves containing asbestos in Connecticut, where the valves were sold and used. Plaintiff lived and worked in Connecticut. Defendant operated an executive and sales office in New York City. Supreme Court found New York had jurisdiction. The First Department reversed, finding that there was no connection between defendant's activities in New York and the injuries suffered by the plaintiff. The court wrote, "All conduct giving rise to plaintiff's claims occurred in Connecticut, as he was not a New York resident, did not purchase or work with defendant's valves in New York, and does not claim to have suffered harm in this state. Without an adequate relationship between New York and plaintiff's claims, specific jurisdiction is lacking, regardless of the extent of a defendant's unconnected activities in the state." So the takeaway here, there must be some connection between a defendant's activities in New York and the plaintiff's injuries before New York jurisdiction over a lawsuit can be justified. Here, plaintiff's injuries and defendant's manufacturing and sales activities, which were alleged to have caused those injuries, took place exclusively in Connecticut. The fact that defendant had an executive and sales office in New York was deemed insufficiently related to the alleged cause of plaintiff's injuries. Next is Chicas, C-H-I-C-A-S, pages 32 and 33. This is a legal malpractice action alleging plaintiff's attorney in the underlying traffic accident case should have sued the tortfeasor personally for damages in excess of the insurance policy limits. Supreme Court dismissed the action. Second Department reversed because the attorney failed to demonstrate plaintiff would not have prevailed in an action against the tortfeasor personally. The court wrote, "Since it was alleged that the defendant's legal malpractice prevented plaintiff from obtaining a judgment against the alleged tortfeasor, the defendants had the burden of affirmatively demonstrating that the plaintiff would not have prevailed against the alleged tortfeasor or that the alleged tortfeasor did not have personal assets such that his motorist insurance policy limit that was recovered in the amount of $50,000 was the maximum judgment that could have been obtained from him, and the defendants failed to do so." So here, the takeaway here is one of the elements of a legal malpractice action is that but for the malpractice, the plaintiff would have prevailed. Here, the attorney bringing the summary judgment motion did not demonstrate the plaintiff would not have prevailed and therefore was not entitled to summary judgment. Next is the Marte case, M-A-R-T-E, pages 34 and 35. This traffic accident case brought up an unusual venue issue. The traffic accident happened in Nassau County, where the defendant corporation had its office. The corporation owned the car in the accident. But the certificate of incorporation designated New York County as the location of defendant's principal place of business. Defendant did not, in fact, have an office or a principal place of business in New York County. Plaintiff brought the suit in New York County, and Supreme Court granted defendant's motion to change venue. The First Department reversed, finding venue in New York County solely based upon defendant's certificate of incorporation was appropriate. The court wrote, plaintiff properly placed venue in New York County based upon the corporate defendant's initial certificate of incorporation designating New York County as the location of its principal office, although the company has no office there. And it says see CPLR Section 503, Subdivision C. While defendants annexed to their moving papers the police report for the subject motor vehicle accident indicating that defendant's vehicle was registered to a Nassau County address on the day of the accident, and an affidavit from the corporate defendant's vice president averring that its office was in Nassau County when the action was commenced, the corporate residence designated in the initial certificate of incorporation controls for venue purposes. So the takeaway here, even though there was no real connection between the defendant in this traffic accident case and New York County, the fact that defendant's certificate of incorporation that was on file designated New York County as the principal place of business for the defendant was enough to support venue in New York County. Next is Basden on page 35. This traffic accident case brings up an evidentiary issue. A no-fault file showing the plaintiff had been injured in 2002 was admissible in the trial. However, the operative and pathology reports that were in the file were not generated by the insurance carrier and therefore should not have been admitted. A new trial on damages was ordered. The court wrote, the court should not have allowed into evidence the operative and pathology reports from the 2002 surgical procedure that were contained in the file of the no-fault insurance carrier. While the no-fault file was properly admitted as a business record under CPLR 4518 Subdivision A, the reports therein were not created by the carrier and were therefore inadmissible. There was no evidence of a relationship between the carrier and the surgeon or the hospital where the procedure was performed, so as to permit the reports to remain as part of the carrier's file. Next is Floricic, F-L-O-R-I-C-I-C, page 37. This traffic accident case against the city alleged roadway signs were removed during road construction, creating confusion which contributed to plaintiff motorcyclist's accident. The theory of liability was negligent roadway design, and the city raised two immunity defenses, which were rejected. The governmental function immunity defense was rejected because it's not available where, as here, the government is engaged in a proprietary function, which is maintaining roads, as opposed to a governmental function. And the city wasn't entitled to qualified immunity. Qualified immunity arises when the city has completed a study of the risks related to the roadway design where the accident occurred, and no such study had been conducted in this case. Next is Suarez, page 38. This personal injury case raised the question about how to handle the claim that the verdict sheet was confusing, which was first brought up after the jury was discharged. Supreme Court set aside the verdict. The First Department reversed, letting the verdict stand, saying that if the plaintiff doesn't object before the jury is discharged, the objection is waived. The court wrote, the trial court should not have set aside the verdict based on a determination that the verdict sheet was, on its face, unclear and confusing. None of the parties or the court perceived any lack of clarity until after the jury was discharged, and there was no evidence in the trial record of substantial juror confusion. Juror affidavits should not be used to impeach a jury verdict absent extraordinary circumstances which are not present here. Plaintiff didn't object to the verdict sheet or the charge until after the jury was discharged and therefore waived those objections. That concludes this January 2023 personal injury update CLE.